Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
Patrons to the Super J-Cast Extra. It is Friday, 10th of April, 2026, and here is another episode of Subscriber Select. This is the show where you, listener, can pick any wrestling match, any era, any promotion. I watch it, you watch it, we talk about it, we record us talking about it, then I upload it to Patreon, and other people can listen to us talking about the match that you picked and we both watched and then talked about. It's a very special one today because I have with me a returning guest and the proprietor of the Yugoya Ryokan, it's Fraser Japan. Fraser, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you, Joel. It's good to be back. One of the first notes I put down was it was a great time to chat, given Sakura Genesis was just about a week or so ago now. I was lucky enough to be in the front row for that, and that was a fantastic outing and sort of re-energized the passion probably for a lot of us. So certainly in the mood to chat some New Japan again, whereas in the past I might not have been.
First thing I want to ask you is, I know you talk to a lot of wrestlers. This is more of a request than a question. I will pay $100 to the first wrestler who comes out at the next Korakuen Hall show holding some sparklers.
Yeah, I've been following your pyro at Korakuen thing, and like everybody else, Joel, I take it very literally, and I know that you are being 100% serious with your suggestion and really not thinking through the fire hazard stuff at all. On a serious note, it's quite amazing to me that people read those tweets and think, this guy's being serious. He has not thought through the fire risks. Like, having pyro at Korakuen could be really dangerous for the audience. So, let me talk to them on that. If it was a little bit of an inside joke to sort of get back at some of these people that seem to have no sense of humor, or the joke flies about 100 kilometers over their head, then I'd be happy to partake in such an exercise.
Do you know how many people have viewed that tweet?
I should pull it up, but no, tell me, what's your view count?
Nearly a quarter of a million people, 221.1, scrumpy, he's just jumped on my lap and knocked my microphone over. 221,000 views, which I think says a lot about the state of Twitter these days and the kind of content that gets reposted and shared. I think there's just something about people's innate desire on that app to mock and ridicule and correct and criticize and dogpile, and I'm glad people are enjoying it. But where's the sense of fun? You know, these people have got no sense of humor and no media literacy. Like, not that the fact that he's unable to pick up on the fact that it's clearly a joke. And I guess it just says a lot about the turnover of fans, that there's one, very few people saw it and understood the reference, because it is a copy paste of a series of, shall I say, infamous tweets from Alan Cheapshot about New Japan not having a women's division. But it's every day I'm checking it and seeing more and more people replying to it, and it is very, very funny to me.
Yeah, one thing I just would say on that, Joe, which is a little bit different maybe from West vs. Japan. In Japan, because Japan is not especially political, as far as Beyond the Border is concerned, it's certainly political within its own borders, but internationally, it's not. So when Musk was doing his running with Trump kind of stuff, where a whole bunch of Americans and others, I think for good reasons, may have decided it was time to jump off, Japan didn't. So Japanese pro wrestling Twitter is still going along quite well. And many of the faces that were previously there are still there. I think the people that have left X or Twitter or whatever you want to call it are not so much people that have got fed up with it being a cesspool or political ideology or anything like that. It's just simply that they've decided no longer to be a fan of New Japan Pro Wrestling. So most of my interactions are with them. I must admit, I am quite free to use the mute and block button on undesirable accounts, wherever they may be. And there does seem to be a trend at times that maybe the West tend to be a little bit more, or Western fans, I should say, tend to be a little bit more sort of black or white. But yeah, I know you always get entertained by these things. I thought the best part of your tweet actually was a thread in inverted commas. So I was waiting for a long list, and Pyro at Korakin was the only item. So if people couldn't find out that there was a joke there, I just don't know what to say. It makes it kind of even better in a way, in kind of a sick way.
Yeah, I think I might just give up the podcast and just become a shitposting account, because that's clearly what I'm best at. But I could just sort of click on one of these people who've replied or quote tweeted it. They're all kids, yeah. Right? These are people who have never heard of us and certainly never listened to the famous episode 97 of a Super J cast, which the tweet is referencing. And just in the bios, there's just a load of words and things I don't understand. Like, yeah, I'm just clicking on one here. 20 years old, demigirl, lesbian, RWBY, wrestling Batgirl, Splatoon fan. I mean, whilst I'm not casting aspersions on these people, I'm sure they're lovely people, but it's not exactly my audience, is it?
Well, Grandpa, I think you may be a little bit out of touch these days, you know, both you and I. The one I just saw just going down the replies, which I thought was quite good. VCOM7418. Oh, wow. You hate capitalized Korakin, huh? I mean, I just don't know what to say. I prefer to look at it in a more comical sense, which is if that's a kind of conclusion about the right reply to send back, then, you know, there's some comedy value in that, I think.
I'd like to now pick your brains a bit about the Ryokan, which,
yeah,
as all listeners know, was a truly magical experience for me and my family. And you've had quite a few visitors, notable visitors to the Ryokan. I also just want to clear up and apologize about mistakenly referring to it as a Rotenburo, because there's no roof on it, as I'm sure all listeners knew, but you were just too polite to reach out to me and correct. It is a Notenburo, as it doesn't have a roof. And yeah, how are you enjoying life as the proprietor of the Ryokan? If you've got any interesting stories that you might feel like sharing?
Yeah, well, maybe firstly, on the whole Rotenburo, Notenburo point, I must admit, Joel, that it was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago that the previous owner corrected me on that one and said it was a Notenburo. And to be honest, having not only just being the owner of the Ryokan, but having gone to stacks of onsen in the past, I'd never heard that term before. And if it makes you feel any better about your shocking mistake, as you seem to be thinking of it as, I was filing away my licenses the other day, and even the public health service refer to it as a rotenburo. So I think this rotenburo point is quite nuanced. But nevertheless, how's Yugoya going? Yeah, well, if we bring it back to New Japan, we've had three active wrestlers so far. So Kato-san and an unnamed individual came along. This was not long before his excursion to Mexico, actually. So it was a good time to chat with him. He's a super, super nice guy, very, very humble, down to earth. He was super excited to be going to Mexico. There was a little bit inside of him because he's only, I don't know, 23, 24, whatever, sense of nervousness about being away from his home country for so long. But Mexico was definitely the destination that he wanted. So really enjoyed hosting him probably back in, I don't know, February maybe it was back then. Then after that, as was more public on Twitter, we had members of the United Empire, and I'm sure listeners know that I come from New Zealand, as does Hinare, so I know him quite well. So him and Great Okan came along to the Ryokan, and Great Okan came with a bit of a backstory or a big up from Hinare, particularly around his eating prowess. So Takahagi-san, the previous owner, who still works there as well alongside me, we were quite sort of unsure about just how much meat we should be buying for Great Okan. And Hinare had been telling me, look, he's been pretty much starving himself a week, getting fired up for, they stayed two nights, by the way, not one, getting fired up for how much you can eat at your ryokan. And he managed to plow his way through 5 kilograms of wagyu in two nights. He skipped the breakfast, and ironically, we'd bought a whole bunch of food for them, but that was fine. But on a more serious note, the highlight of that trip for me was on the middle day, we went to a different town to the one I took you and your family to. It's a town called Aizu Wakamatsu, which is a famous kind of samurai town. And I could bore listeners with history, but I won't go into it too much. But it's a fascinating story around the castle burning down. And up on a hill was a young group of soldiers, about 15 to 17 years old. They were called the Byokutai. They're very famous in Japan. These raiders had come down from south in Yamaguchi, and when these guys up on the hill saw that the castle was on fire, they committed seppuku, and sort of in Japanese culture, that's very honorable as opposed to what it might be perceived to be in the West. And Oka is a real, real history nerd, and he was really, really in. We went to both the castle and this hill, and he was very, very kind as well, not just to do his own reading, because at most of the Japanese attractions, I'd say 70-75% of the language is in Japanese, and you get sporadic English interpretations, but he was giving me a full rundown of it. And to be honest, I had been here two or three times before with Nihonjin as well, but I learned so much from his time there that it was really, really good. So I think he really enjoyed himself, obviously enjoyed playing through all the meat and enjoying the onsen and everything. It was actually the history day in between, believe it or not, that was the big element of that particular trip. Otherwise, it's pretty busy there at the moment. Japan's new fiscal year starts on the 1st of April every year, as a lot of listeners will know. So there's a lot of change that's associated with that. Busy building a new website. The previous owner's one is pretty old. And we have the pleasure next Friday of having a public hygiene inspection from the local health office. So that's quite a serious thing, apparently. So we've got to get ready for that. And then we've got two other big things after that, which is that while a lot of listeners might have seen a lot of cherry blossom or sakura mankai, which is full bloom, on their feeds at the moment. Because we're up in the middle of the mountains, our sakura mankai won't blossom until the end of this month. Then after that, it's Golden Week at the beginning of May. So we have quite a lengthy sort of busy but interesting period. And I won't name names, but one of your discourse members will be staying for a couple of nights during sakura mankai. So I think you've done a good job, Joel, pimping out the ryokan to your listenership. And sorry, one last thing I would just say, which is not really related to the ryokan specifically, but more the implications of moving out to the countryside, which is that I now live in a town called Shirakawa, which is the one I picked you up from the station at, in Fukushima, which is about a 50-minute drive from the ryokan. But very handily, it's an hour 20 only by bullet train to Tokyo Station. So when there's a show that I want to go and see, even if it's on a weeknight, it's no problem. I've got a girlfriend. She lives in Tokyo, so I can crash at hers or get a hotel or whatever. So, for example, on the 20th, Hinari and Okan are challenging Bishimon for the right to fight KOB in Hiroshima. And that's the main event at Kotokuen. So I can just, you know, jump on the website, buy a ticket. And there's no big deal about sort of going there and back same day or alternatively staying in Tokyo. So I feel like I've got a nice balance in life now. And I think as far as pipeline goes, I won't name names, but there are three members of the roster in particular I'm quite keen to get out there. Hinare is kind of my go-to guy to hit up some of these people. So I'm hopeful that as time passes, we'll be able to share that. And I'm somewhat reluctant to say this one because I might jinx it, but I've got another friend, this is not New Japan, who's friend with a sumo wrestler or Rikishi in the Makauchi division, who we think might come as well. And that, to me, would be one of the ultimate gets. So we will just have to wait and see if this all comes to pass. And if it does, of course, I'll let you know. And to the extent they're open to PR, then we'll be putting that up on Instagram or flicking a few photos around.
I would love to see at least one of these people at the Pokemon Play Park in Yanaizu. I'm bitterly disappointed that Hinari and Okan weren't up for that. I could just imagine Great Okan going down the big Chansey slide. We're really missing a trick there, but yeah, it's great to hear that everything's going well. I'm looking forward to hearing about more stories in the future about the big names.
Yeah, the last thing I'd say on the Ryokan is that I became official owner on the 1st of January this year. And to be frank, the first 3 months were pretty tough. That was all about learning what the fuck am I doing. I used to be a banker. Now all of a sudden I'm running a hotel, running a restaurant, running an onsen. And there was a lot of things I didn't know. And then on top of that, all the change of ownership stuff is all in Japanese. So I'm scrolling through pages and pages of Japanese. My Japanese is getting better, but still it's not nearly as quick as doing things in English. But I feel like now that we're in April, really getting to the point now where I kind of know what I'm doing. The muscle memory is there. And now I can think more strategically about, you know, how do we get occupancy rates up? You know, what PR do we use? What social media do we use? And what other local connections to make? So sort of transition now from the hard part to the fun part, I say. So life is good out here at the moment.
It's great to hear. Let's transition over to New Japan, specifically modern day New Japan, because we did a bit of audio prior to Wrestle Kingdom talking about the direction of the company and things that we wanted to see happen in, let's say, like the first quarter of 2026. Now, whilst I can't remember specifically what all of the things we said were, I do feel that most of the things we talked about have come to pass. So you were in the building for Sakura Genesis, and I think that's always a good kind of benchmark for where New Japan are at in the year. So what are your thoughts on the current product and what was it like at Sakura Genesis as a live attendee?
Well, I will just say one cautionary note at the beginning was that I was lucky enough, and you're at the mercy of the lottery, but I got a front row seat for Sakura Genesis, and my view from the front row, because sometimes you can be on the end or sometimes you can be stuck behind the cameraman or something. I know it's first world problems and everything, but my seat was kind of like perfect. And I think whenever you get there, you tend to think everything is maybe better than what it might be for the average punter. And also, interestingly, going back to the previous owner, I decided to show him and his family a Masuseki or a box seat to go to the show because they had just hosted, because they were there when Great Okan and Hinari came as well. And they obviously, United Empire, were pretty prominent throughout that show. So it's good fun for them. I think for me, before the show, I didn't go to that, you know, Junior Genesis or whatever they call it at Kotokuen. And I thought the undercard looked a bit mama to me, or mama in Japanese, kind of like so-so, not so exciting. With the exception of sort of Osprey's return, there seemed to be a lot of stuff that you think sort of belongs, you know, on a house show or whatever. But I think the vibe for a lot of that ended up being pretty good. I can't remember every single match, but I thought Osprey's return was awesome. That live pop he gets when he does the, you know, the Osprey chants and stuff. And I know it's probably sacrilegious to mention this, But I did watch Hanade and Akira and Callum's appearance on AEW last night as well. The US fans don't go anywhere near as good as the Japanese fans do on that one. I thought throughout the night that maybe Ospreay's was an interesting one, right? When Callum won, you know, sort of characters aside and all that, you can only imagine what must have been going through the minds of both of them and stuff. And I think that is a special moment, irrespective of whatever tension might be building up. As far as the tension goes, I felt like maybe Ospreay was doing his soap opera stuff a little bit too obviously. I think a little bit more subtle might have been better. But if I go back to individual matches, like we talked about Ospreay, then I think the last three were of substance, right? Takeshita, Umino. I'm a big Takeshita fan. I was a little disappointed that I felt that the pacing of the match, for a 15-minute match, the first half or so was pretty slow. It really got going in the second half, but I thought they would go balls to the wall right from the start. And now it seems, I guess, that Umino seems to be like Takeshita's or ally or whatever. And I think if there's one good thing about that, it means we don't have to be subjected to Rocky Romero coming out with Takeshita every single time. And I do kind of think Umino's nailed his in-ring stuff. So if you can get the character part right, that would be great. But they still, with Takeshita, they got a hot commodity there, but they're still fucked around on his character. So that kind of took away. Then we got to the semi-main, and that was outstanding, right? And Oscar made a huge impression. And when I talked to that family of the previous owner straight after the match, the first thing they were talking about was how awesome Oscar was. And I know he was only really in there for about the first 5 minutes before he got taken out. But that 5 or 6 minutes was amazing. And they're like, oh, does Hinare know Oscar well? We really want Oscar to come to the Ryokan. And I was like, oh, let me check on that. But then after Oscar's bit, obviously Yuto, you know, was the star for the last 15 or 20 or whatever. And I thought he was outstanding. But it's always easy to focus on the winners. But I thought as far as Team DK, when Zach especially, like his bumping for Oscar in particular, just to show the powers, was insane. He's just so good at getting other guys over, and he really seems focused on that as opposed to a lot of others that might resent the fact that they're not winning on the night. And then the main was, I thought was outstanding. Callum has really got his in-ring stuff really down. I think his selling is great. The psychology is great. And there's one move that sticks out for me, and I'm not that good with move names, as was evidenced when I was watching Kenny versus Naito, but there was one thing where he kind of he just had a delayed, like, sort of brainbuster backdrop, whatever you want to call it, and the angle he had on it was kind of past the perpendicular, so it wasn't that easy to balance it up, and he just nailed that perfectly. And I just get the feeling that, you know, 3 years down the track, when he's 26, apparently he might be 46 according to all these rumors, that he will be just an absolute phenom. So I'm very, very glad that New Japan have got him for 3 years. So I end my little spiel there.
And did you see any of the AEW appearances from that trio?
I did, actually. And just in case anybody's about to cancel me listening from your hardcore Patreon base, I only bought the AEW, whatever it is, AEW, my AEW, whatever, for that particular thing. So did you see it, Joel, at all or not?
I've seen highlights
of it. Be honest.
People are reacting to this as you'd expect. Like, I've seen some quotes from Tony Khan praising Callum Newman, and people are getting upset about that. And it's like, look, guys, he's got the 3-year contract. After that, he's gone, right? If you just make peace with that and try to enjoy the run while it lasts and see how it benefits, A, the company, and B, the wrestlers around him, then I think that is the way to appreciate things. And I think the match that you've picked for us to talk about today is a good kind of case in point for that, where we understand the ecosystem of New Japan Pro Wrestling, that these Western wrestlers come into the company with lots of talent and build up their star power, have loads of great matches, great storylines, and then leave. And that's okay. So just make your peace with that and try not to let the AEW appearances and the talk from Tony Khan spoil that for you.
Yeah, I mean, I did actually watch the full, it went for quite a long time. It was the main event. It went for about 30 minutes. And I did watch all of it last night. I was at the Ryokan. And the notes that I kind of put down was that the commentary team were very, very effusive of their praise of the United Empire guys. It wasn't like they were sort of putting their own guys over and sort of saying, who the hell are these guys? I thought Akira was spectacular. It might be controversial to say, and I don't mean this as a dig, but I kind of wonder, junior-wise, does he need potentially a third dance partner as well down at that level? Then I think Hinata, again, I'm biased, but I thought he looked outstanding as well. He took quite a few risky moves. He took a table spot. He put Claudio through a table and had to climb up those steel steps that they use on the way up there. So landing that was quite difficult. What I didn't like, which is more about the overall product, was that I really don't like the camera work of AEW as opposed to what I see in New Japan. I know Ospreay's commented on that before. And then again, just like this, whenever Moxley's involved, it almost inevitably becomes a plunder match, which it in part was. And I think I would have, and again, this is just my New Japan bias, but would have preferred to see a bit more. But I think one of the concerning things for me is, you know, Hiromu mentioned it once before, right, that Tony Khan does a much better job than what the Bushiroad guys seem to do about actually showing genuine appreciation for what the guys do. And I think that's something that, you know, sort of bringing it back to New Japan side, they've really got to look at. And I don't think that's just culturally, right? Like, they are more reserved as a more general matter, but I think that's something that really sticks in the mind of some of the people. And Hiromu banged on about that for a long, long time, and I get the sense nothing much has changed on either side since then.
Yeah, it seems quite rare that you would see someone like Kidani or Sugabayashi or Tanahashi publicly praising a New Japan wrestler or a performance in a particular match or a particular show. So I think there's a lot of lessons that could be learned on the New Japan side from what is the appeal of working in AEW. And it's, I don't think it is just the money. I think obviously the fact that New Japan is starting to get some of these guys tied down to 3-year deals instead of the usual, you know, handshake deals or rolling contracts that they do is a sign that they are learning and adapting. So yeah, like I said, no one is expecting the foreign wrestlers to be staying in New Japan permanently, but I think we could certainly be doing more to extend and maximize the time that they do have in New Japan. Just one last thing, right? Obviously, the Japanese fan base are a monolith, and you, as the white man, can speak on their behalf. Like, what do you feel is the general sort of consensus on the product at the moment from the New Japan fans that you speak to? Are they quite keen on the direction? They're happy, excited with Callum Newman being the champion, and you know, even just from like the atmosphere inside the building and how they reacted to Callum winning the title?
Yeah, I'll just say two things. Just to finally finish off on AEW, you started off by mentioning there's a lot of maybe New Japan fans a bit pansy about Callum Newman being over there. One thing, if you watch that match quite closely, Callum doesn't spend much time in the ring. And at least one of the theories going around is don't show off your best merchandise too much or it may no longer be yours. As far as the Japanese fan base goes, again, you know, sort of jokes aside, I can't really speak for everyone. The way I tend to think about more the Japanese fan base is probably of the Japanese fans that I made good connections with, are they still around or not? It's definitely true to say, just, and I'm talking more broader than Sakura Genesis, but a lot of people left and actually went across to Noah, believe it or not, when Naito went there, despite his current condition. So that certainly has taken away some of the fans. The Wrestle Kingdom, which you were there for, was obviously a massive success, but, you know, Tanahashi's retirement, clearly key to that. As far as Callum's win goes, I think that was pretty well received. I must admit, as far as the actual sort of online social media stuff goes afterwards, I'd just been too flat out to really follow it too closely. But I think his performance in the final was very, very strong. I think the one thing that maybe people are a little bit confused about, And I don't know if this is a perception thing or not, but Tsuji felt like a bit of a supporting act in that whole match. You know, like the angle that I had where I was sitting was looking directly into Callum's corner. So I thought I was going to take this kick-ass photo with, you know, all the United Empire guys straddling the outside of the ring, but annoyingly the cameraman was in the middle. Whereas Tsuji just came out with Daiki and the guy, right? And it just felt like, you know, with Ospreay coming back and everything, you just felt like the whole theme of the night was United Empire. So what becomes of Tsuji, I think, is a little bit of a concern for people. And of all people, AEW t-shirt wearing Gabe Kidd turns up just to give him power driver outside of the ring for good measure and challenges him for the other bout that people forgot still technically belongs to Tsuji after that. So I think if there's definitely support for Callum, although one objective measure you could look at, which not just includes Japanese fans, but his Twitter or X account has got a really small following, actually, which is just one indication that people kind of haven't caught on yet. I am very confident they will. Japanese crowds are very good at understanding, and I think he's got that balance, and maybe we'll talk about it when we get to Omega Naito, that while he is a heel, he's not at the sort of House of Torture level, which is kind of like, you know, just doing bullshit after bullshit, riff bump after riff bump. It was a good one of Red Shoes getting a curb stomp. But I feel like he's got proper wrestling skills, and people can see that in the ring. So I'm pretty confident people will get behind him, but it's probably a bit too early to call just whether or not, you know, they're enamored by him or not at this early stage.
Let's move on to talk about the match that you've picked for us to discuss today, which is Tetsuya Naito versus Kenny Omega from the G1 Climax 26 semi-final, block final, not sure what we want to call this one, from August 14th, 2016. So why did you pick this one?
One main reason, to be honest, which is just for whatever reason, this match stays in the memory a lot. So quite often, and ironically, wrestlers ask me this question, you'd think it'd be the other way around, but sometimes when the wrestlers come to the ryokan, they'll be like, so I deliberately don't try to talk about wrestling too much with them because I think it's like they get that all the time. You know, the ryokan's a relaxing place in the middle of the countryside. Let's talk about something else. But they do quite often ask, especially when they first arrive, what's your favorite match? You know, you've been here 10 years or whatever. And I often point to this one. I was lucky enough to be there live. It was at Ryogoku, just like Sakura Genesis. And I just thought it was a superb match in isolation. And on top of that, it was, for Kenny especially, a really important match in terms of his career. And I suppose 10 years removed from the fact, when you look at the health condition of especially Naito, but also Kenny as well, and you look at some of the bumps they took and the sacrifices that they made, it makes you appreciate it even more. Now, I am not a star or ratings person or whatever, but out of sheer curiosity, I thought I'll go see what Meltzer and Cage Match had to say. And before Meltzer introduced his controversial Infinity ratings system, it got 5 stars, and Cage Match has got it at 9.72. So it made me feel that, okay, I'm not the only person who was really into that match. And there was a lot of things when I think back to that are very nostalgic for me. So that's why I picked it.
Yeah, it's one of the defining matches of modern New Japan. I know a load of other people love this match. I know it's one of John Carroll's favourites as well. I think they might have been in the building for this one too, because it was more than just the G1 block decider. It feels in a lot of ways like the moment where the New Japan golden era fully arrived. Because if you look at where both guys are by the summer of 2016, they've completely reinvented themselves. So Naito obviously gone from this rejected baby-faced Stardust Genius character to the leader of Los Ingobernables de Japón. Kenny Omega has gone from sort of semi-comedic junior heavyweight outsider to become new leader of Bullet Club, kicking out AJ Styles after he goes to WWE. So looking back on this match now with over a decade of hindsight, it does feel like the beginning of a new era to me. And I know we talked off the air, you picked this match partly because it happened not long after you arrived in Japan. So could you please talk to us about your timeline as a resident in Japan and how that lined up with your wrestling fandom?
Yeah, so I arrived in Japan, I think it was about June 2015, so roughly just over a year before that And the purpose of moving was that I took on a role as Japan CFO for a global investment bank. And I think it's fair to say, a little bit like the Ryokan experience I was just talking about before, the first 3 to 6 months was really grappling with the new role and making sure I knew my way around and everything. So to be honest, I didn't really follow New Japan too closely for the rest of 2015. And it was at Wrestle Kingdom 10 on January 4th, which was kind of the starting point to really start getting very active. It felt like, you know, the job was under control. I knew what I was doing. And at that point, I could go to a lot more. So I had always known about the G1 and, I don't know, being a bit of a stats nerd and liking the concept of wins and losses having meaning, G1 has always stood out for me. And I think that year I went to about, 10 shows or something like that, probably the ones around Tokyo and the ones not too far away because I didn't know my geography all that well. So this was basically my first G1, you could call it. And having watched things like WWE on TV in Singapore, which is where I was living and working before that, and then suddenly seeing this and like guys like Shibata, guys like Kenny, Naito, Omega, Tanahashi, you had the two outsiders of Nakajima, Marufuji, and I was like, holy shit, like, how the fuck did I not know about this earlier? And being there live, and I'm grateful for the work opportunities that came my way, just further enhanced it. And when I went along to that G1, I was like, shit, years in the future, to the extent work gives me the latitude, I'm going to go to all of this. It's just so good. And of course, one thing you don't really realize is when you first rock up to a new country and a new promotion, and you just sort of jump in and it's awesome, you just naturally assume, well, it must always be like this. It must have always been this good and it must continue to be this good. Of course, back then, two big things that exist or have transpired today that weren't there at the time. One was AEW, and ironically, we'll get to Kenny's speech a little bit later on, perhaps. And then, of course, COVID came smack bang in the middle of the 10-year period that we're talking about. But that was kind of, in summary, just my first G1.
So were you a New Japan fan before you'd moved to New Japan? Like, what is your history as a wrestling fan? Like, how did you get into wrestling?
So it goes all the way back to my childhood. I'm originally from New Zealand, and the anecdote I'd like to share about that was that somewhere randomly when I was about 7 or 8 years old, WWE suddenly popped up on television at, 10 or 11 or something like that at night. And being young, you needed parental consent to stay out that late, and my parents were not overly fond of these guys in spandex pretending to fight each other. And I remember one night in particular, my parents were actually quite conservative, quite religious and stuff like that. So they never really kind of mocked me or anything like that. But there was one night where they were really saying, look, Fraser, we don't think it's a good idea you're watching this wrestling. It's just garbage. I said, no, it's not. Like, just hang out for one more match and watch it with me. And, of course, who should come out next but the Red Rooster, Terry Taylor. And the Red Rooster was doing his, his pecking on the ground and stuff like that. And they were just in tears laughing at this. And I was like, oh, don't mock my hobby and stuff. And I was, 8 or 9 or whatever. So I was quite sensitive, right? And basically I ended up bawling my eyes out and going off to my bedroom because my parents were just mercilessly mocking this. But I somehow survived that very traumatic experience. And back then, the pay-per-views were doing the rounds on tapes in New Zealand. So at school, you could rock up at high school and somebody would randomly, I don't know where they got them from, but would have the Royal Rumble on videotape or something like that, or WrestleMania 4 or something along those lines. So I watched it then, and then sort of like everybody else, flashed out for a while, came back in around about the time of the Monday Night Wars. And then I started reading, and you'll know this being a UK guy yourself, Joel, that what I thought was an excellent magazine at the time, Power Slam. And Power Slam always had the Japanese column. Now, I was never into Japanese tape trading or anything like that. So when it comes to people like the young boy Josh over at Keeping It Strong Style with Damon, my memory or my knowledge really only really goes back to when I first came over here. Before that, I know a few anecdotes and stuff, but not a great deal. So Power Slam, though, I was always fascinated reading about it. So I knew a lot of the characters and supposedly what they did, but I never really saw any of it. So it was quite exciting when I rocked up. Although what I would say, just to clarify, is that when I came over in 2016, let's call it, the 5 years before that was spent with the same company in Singapore, and I had a regional role. So I used to have to come up to Japan sort of once or twice a year, and May was always the time I used to come up. So it was always Best of Super Juniors. So I distinctly remember watching like Devitt versus Ricochet and a few of these other matches. So, and Ibushi as well was sort of coming on the scene back then as well. So that was still was not enough for me to get into watching New Japan on a full-time basis. But I sort of had a half-ass idea of what was going on before then. But I was much more of a May-only man, so I didn't really appreciate the prestige and the interest that G1 generated until I got up here.
I had a very similar experience with my parents. My dad used to take the piss out of me because he'd kind of come in and over here and watch a bit of what I was watching. And he used to do like a Jim Ross impression. He'd just, every time it was on, he'd just walk in the room and go, "The Rock," and then walk out again. And so I feel your pain when it comes to mockery of something I enjoyed growing up. So what do you remember about where New Japan was culturally in 2016? Like, did it feel something that was getting bigger and more mainstream while you were there?
I'd say it's very hard for me to speak on a relative basis just because when you say bigger, because I didn't really know what it was like until I jumped in. As far as its mainstream popularity went, I mean, most of the conversations that I'd have, so as CFO, I used to often go around and talk to heads of trading desks, right? Like the head of, I don't know, Japanese government bond trading desk or the equities trading desk or whatever. And these tended to be older guys. And whenever you decided that it was safe enough to say, oh, you know, one of my hobbies is pro wrestling, like they would always hark back to like the Inoki era and stuff like that, right? And talk about those kind of guys and say, yeah, when I was a kid, I used to love it, but now it's a bit ma-ma. And then I'd say something like, oh, do you know Okada? No. Do you know Tanahashi? Oh, I think I've heard of him. It was that kind of thing. So I think the mainstream was much more dated, and that was reflected a little bit, and probably still to this day, by where New Japan sits on TV scheduling. Like, I think it's on at something like Super on TV Sahi, like midnight or 1 a.m. or something like that. It's not at a good time. So that's why whenever for things like Tanahashi's retirement and Dominion, they make a big deal about that being broadcast live, because ordinarily it's not. And I think guys like Aaron Wolf, despite, you know, what people, hardcore fans may think about his current capability or not, but he's a big name and he can draw those kind of people in. But back then, I think it was a little bit similar to what you might hear in the West. It was like, yeah, when we were younger, we used to watch, but we don't anymore.
So if I think back to 2016, it's often remembered as something approaching the peak of the mid-2010s boom, because you had the big departures, so Shinsuke Nakamura, AJ Styles, Kyle Anderson, they all left for WWE
Don't you dare leave out Doc Gallows. How dare you?
About it.
He should have been first.
Sorry to any Doc Gallows enjoyers. Yeah, Doc Gallows, very unfair of me to leave him out there. So Doc Gallows, yes, of course, part of that important quartet who left the company. You think on paper, that might have been disastrous. And that was like the first real notable exodus of talent for New Japan. Yeah. But instead, New Japan turned that uncertainty into an opportunity. So you have Kazuchika Okada remaining as the ace, and they made some very smart moves to sort of solidify his position there. Hiroshi Tanahashi still somewhere in his prime, still the company's emotional center. They promoted Tetsuya Naito, so Naito kind of moved up to that 1B slot vacated by Nakamura. And then Kenny Omega moving into the slot vacated by AJ Styles as maybe somewhat unexpectedly becoming the top Gokukujin star, if I'm using that term correctly. And the company starting to become more visible internationally, getting some buzz abroad in the West and NJPW World. That's becoming easier to access. There's more fans outside Japan watching. And just a growing sense that New Japan is becoming the cool wrestling promotion.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Fair to the point that I'm not really sure what else to to be saying there. I think maybe the one point that sort of came to mind when you're talking about that is perhaps the difference between, say, 2006 or 2015-16 departures and replacements as opposed to now is that I think you can say quite safely and objectively that while you had a quartet of guys leaving with the prowess of people like Doc Gallows, as you went out of your way to point out, like, you did have a bench that was pretty strong, and I think most people would have felt that, you know, in the instance of, say, Naito and Kenny, you had guys that could really go, okay, maybe nobody really saw their full potential apart from guys like Ghetto and all that until they really put it on a match like this. But now when we've had AEW not just take four guys, but take however many that they've taken, and I find this kind of ironic in a way, and I don't mean this as a sort of an AEW rant, but, you know, back in 2016, the big fear for fans back then was that this WWE Japan thing was going to spring up and suddenly, you know, everybody on the New Japan roster was going to be working for WWE Japan NXT or something like that. And in reality, like, WWE have not taken, on the men's side at least, they have taken a lot of Joshi wrestlers, but they didn't really take that many. But AEW have taken so many that I think the concern, at least what I think, and a lot of Japanese fans think like this, is that the bench is not nearly as strong as what it was back then. And I think, to me, that's a key difference. That's not to say we don't have anybody, but, you know, your 1B, 1C replacement type analogy that you're talking about before, I think these days is very, very different to what it was back then.
So let's talk a bit about Tetsuya Naito's journey going into this match, because it's one of the great wrestling reinventions. So earlier in his career, you get the sense New Japan desperately wanted him to be the next Hiroshi Tanahashi. Wins the G1 in 2013. He's positioned as top babyface with the Stardust Genius gimmick, but fans didn't buy it. They rejected him. He was, I don't know, seen as bland or too forced. He was certainly a terrific wrestler. Like, I think the in-ring stuff from Stardust Genius Naito absolutely holds up. But of course, we got this infamous low point at Wrestle Kingdom 8, January 2014, where fans voted to remove his IWGP heavyweight title challenge against Okada from the main event. But rather than fighting against that rejection, he disappears to CMLL. He has a short stint, goes to Mexico, comes back, completely different attitude, forms LIJ. I mean, listeners, you already know all this stuff, but it felt like in 2016 he was the most interesting man of the company, because he's got this kind of effortlessly cool persona, disrespectful to everyone and everything, kind of tapping into that kind of underlying sense that a lot of people, I was going to say in Japan, but I think globally, we all have of wanting to just be a little shit at work and be disrespectful to everyone and our bosses. And he's like straddling this kind of tweener role, is simultaneously a heel, but also being the most popular wrestler in the promotion. Because when he re-debuted as LIJ Naito in, when was that? Was that in earlier in 2016 when he came back, or 2015?
15,
that's right. So yeah, when he started the LIJ thing, they were cheating heels. They were kind of doing what, to some extent, House of Torture do. And, you know, it wasn't to the frequency of cheating and heel interference that they do, but it was there. You know, they were breaking the rules. And I remember at the time, people having very mixed reactions to that. Damon famously very very slow to come round to Ingobernable Naito. But why do you think Naito is and was so popular with the fans?
I think it was a whole anti-establishment point, to be honest. Like, he really seemed to be an excellent wrestler. He had a very cool thing. One of his favorite things that I used to like about Naito was he'd go, like, whack a guy over the head with a chair, and the referee would turn around to admonish him. He'd just, like, you know, do the hand gesture, tranquilo, it's not a big deal, I just hit a guy over the head with a chair, what's your problem kind of thing. So I think people really bought into that. And for me, maybe the most iconic moment for him, and it reflected, I think, the fact that he was so popular that, you know, the comment was often made that he's one of those guys that transcends the belt. He doesn't really need it to be supported that well because people just love him so much. And you'll probably remember, or you will remember rather, 2016 at Invasion Attack, and that was it. I remember that for various reasons. It was Ospreay's debut, amongst others. Was that he won the belt. Sonata debuted and did a run-in. And Naito, after winning, famously just threw the belt up in the air and walked off. And I just thought, like, you know, not only is that cool, but I think it's quite creative as well. He wasn't just doing stuff that you see from your average heel. And I think it was that part that did it. And then, actually, just to switch for 1 second, because it reminds me of an anecdote when, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, I don't think it's overly secretive, but when Okan and Hinare were at the Ryokan, Okan was talking about getting over and stuff. And he was asking a question to Hinare and me, maybe from a fan perspective. He's like, why do you think Naito was so good? Was it his in-ring wrestling, or was it his mic skills? Which I think is sort of mic skills slash charisma. I say, look, I think he's pretty good at both, but I didn't think any Japanese wrestler could touch him on the mic, right? And when he used to do his roll call at the end and just his general speeches and stuff, that's what drew people into him. He kind of had a good look, albeit an interesting haircut. He was a good wrestler. He didn't care about authorities. He was good on the mic. And I think the other smart thing that Naito did as well, which does enhance his popularity, is that he was very, very selective about who he brought into the group. And the best analogy I can think of, or the best point I can think of, is who his pin eater was, which is Bushi, right? And normally your pin eater is a guy that, okay, needs to be there. Maybe not the most popular guy in the company, but so many people used to have Bushi masks and stuff like that, even though he was like the sort of bottom ranking guy of the group. Evil kind of was popular and showed his charisma in time as well. Sonata kind of had that cool, I don't give a shit gimmick at the start as well. He brought in Takagi, who was amazing from Dragon Gate. Titan was amazing from CMLL. So I think he was very, very thoughtful about who he brought in as well, which I think, you know, all those factors combined equals a very popular wrestler.
So as you mentioned earlier in 2016, Naito defeated Okada to win the IWGP Heavyweight Championship, only to lose it back at Dominion in June. So that made this G1 feel really important for him, because winning could be his chance to not only prove that his title reign was not a fluke, but also to achieve his dream of main eventing Wrestle Kingdom, which had famously been snatched away from him and he was very resentful about. So, I mean, looking back on it now, do you think Naito's anti-establishment character became more meaningful because fans had seen him fail first? And I'm just sort of curious what we can learn from this in terms of the current crop of wrestlers. Like, I'm thinking, is there some sort of magic recipe here that guys like Yuya or Shota or Oiwa might be able to tap into? Or do you think it's something that needs to happen purely organically?
Well, I do think it was organic, but I definitely agree with you that sort of the anti-establishment thing sort of has ties back to the failed face run and potentially what path he was potentially forced to go down, although I'm somewhat reluctant to speak too much to that because that was before my time. But of the names you listed down, I think Shota is a prime candidate to go down that path. I think Oiwa in particular is probably a little bit early for that. Yuya, I could see him ending up there. But to me, and again, I might be projecting here, this is just from a view from the outside, but I feel like Yuya's problems largely sit with Yuya rather than anybody else. Whereas Shota has certainly been pushed, I think, beyond his means at times. And I think the combination of that was riding that shitty motorbike into his prolonged main event with Zach at Wrestle Kingdom, whatever it was. And I think Shota's got it in him to be quite a badass heel as well. Maybe a different type of heel to what Naito was. But for whatever reason, they haven't gone down that path so far. But you see sort of his in-ring psychology within the match, you know, he's got this kind of evil eye stares and glances that he does. So I think he's got that within him. So if anyone was to learn from Naito, Shota to be would be the one.
Let's move on to Kenny Omega and his journey into this match, because his rise was arguably just as dramatic. So for years up until this point, he'd been known as this eccentric, but an incredibly talented junior heavyweight wrestler. So obviously he's got his background in DDT, but within New Japan, he'd had very good matches with Kota Ibushi and later with Kushida. But there were still a lot of questions about whether he could make that transition to be a serious heavyweight main eventer. And there were a lot of doubters at the time because he was doing silly things like, you know, using the cold spray can against opponents or the shaved arms, like he'd shave his arms 2-3 days before a match and use the stubble as a chainsaw, use that against Taguchi at Wrestle Kingdom match. And a lot of people were looking at him thinking, what, this guy, this is going to be your new AJ Styles? And people were not buying it at the time. But what was your awareness and perception of Kenny Omega before he became a heavyweight? Or was this your jumping in point for him?
No, I saw the tail end of his junior run because I, as I mentioned before, like Wrestle Kingdom 10 was kind of the first major show I went to where he lost the junior bout to Kushida. But I guess if you look at back in retrospect, that was just an elevation, right? Because the next night he went on to be take out AJ Styles and take over the Bullet Club. So he didn't need a junior bout around his waist to do that. The other thing, which English commentary mentioned this as well when I was watching back, is that Japanese fans are very promotion-centric. And Kenny being a DDT guy and really kind of leaning into the DDT style was quite a big factor about why New Japan fans treated him with caution. And I can even remember, probably mentioned this anecdote before, but in 2018 at the G1 final, Kenny versus Tanahashi, and he had Kenny cornered by Ibushi, Tanahashi cornered by Shibata. A lot of fans calling that, even, you know, there's a couple of years on, there's a DDT versus New Japan final. So a lot of people were looking at him as an outsider who engaged in a lot of the so-called silly wrestling. And I'm not saying I share that view, but nevertheless, that's what some people thought. And the other thing I distinctly remember about that tournament, I don't know why this one sticks in my mind, but early on in the tournament, and I didn't check exactly where it was, you know, night, whatever it was, but he fought Yoshihashi at Kotokin quite early on in the G1, and he lost. And nobody really thought, like, oh, my God, because this was back in the days where Damon was using the label a bag of socks, if I recall correctly, for Yoshihashi. So he wasn't exactly setting the world alight. But I'm quite confident that he pinned Kenny at Kotokin, maybe in, like, I don't know, first or second match of the night, no big deal. Nobody thought really much of it. And, of course, you look back at the end of the tournament and say, oh, my God, how did that happen? But people just didn't see it coming, which I think was the best maybe part about the whole thing, that obviously Gedo saw something that a lot of other fans maybe didn't think was wrong, but certainly didn't see coming. And I think the other thing that maybe was relevant for both of them was that I distinctly remember that night, everybody was expecting it to be either Tanahashi or Okada in the final against whoever won this match. And of course, they were in Block A, so they fought first. And much to everybody's surprise, well, maybe not everyone's surprise, but it went to a time limit draw. So randomly, Goto popped up on something like 11 points to be the block winner. And a lot of people were thinking, oh, shit, if Goto's made it through and he hasn't been on fire lately, whoever wins this B-block semi will probably be the one that goes on to win the whole thing, which just added to the stakes as well.
Right. So, obviously, Kenny Omega's taking this spot vacated by AJ Styles. And as I mentioned, a lot of skepticism about whether or not he could prove he belonged in that role. And as you've laid out, given what happened in the A-block, that imbued this match with, you know, an extra layer of significance. And this G1, so he beat people like Evil and Honma, Nagata, Nakajima, Yano. So as you mentioned, he lost to Yoshihashi, also lost to Michael Elgin and Shibata to set up this match with Naito to decide the winner of the B block and potentially become the first non-Japanese wrestler to win the G1 climax in its current form. So sets the table for this match with Naito to be a battle between essentially like two men trying to prove that they deserve to lead the company into the future. Do you remember how fans in Japan reacted to Kenny in 2016? Like, was there any skepticism or did people buy into him quickly? And like, did you see the potential for him to become the star that he is today?
Well, before I do that, you just listed a couple of things here. So I'm just going to randomly interject with two trivia questions for you, Joel. Number one, Kenny Omega, and it's mentioned on commentary, had quite a big gash on his back. Do you remember what it was in the G1 tournament that caused that?
No, I don't.
No. It was, you may remember at the time that Evil had a bit of obsession with chairs. He used to do that baseball one, but it was not actually the baseball one that did it. He set up two chairs outside the ring and then thought it would be a good idea to back suplex Kenny onto those. And that's where Kenny got quite a nasty gash actually from that one. So that was one. The second trivia question was, we're talking about the B block finalists, numbers 1 and 2. Do you know who came third in the B block that year? Open Google and just pause a little bit.
I'm trying to think. So I would imagine Shibata would have been up there. And I don't know if Nakajima would have accrued enough points at that point to be in the conversation. I'd say Shibata, but I've got a feeling it's going to be a surprise.
It is a surprise, a rather controversial figure. Michael Elgin was third place in B block. So we better leave the conversation there on that point. So, look, I don't pretend to be any wrestling Nostradamus. I think, like a lot of fans, the sheer brilliance of Kenny, if you want to put it like that, is really came out probably in that match for me. He had a couple of other ones, but, you know, if you ran through the people that he beat, right, and there's a lot of average names in there. Like, it's not going to be like a match against Yano is going to show just what a fantastic wrestler Kenny was. So I think it really was this match that showed everybody what he could do. The athleticism for sure was on display back in the Best of Super Junior days. I mentioned before he used to fight once a year and I used to see him, but because he was clowning around so much, it was really hard to see a sort of full package there. So I think it was really only then. And then one other thing after the G1 that really helped him get over was that the promo he did when he won the final against Goto, for the first time he busted out very, we call it peta peta or fluent Japanese on the audience, and that won him over big time. Because not only was he the first guy Kokujin to win the G1, but he could speak fluent Nihongo as well. And he referred to after this match as Japan being his home. So I think it was, you know, sort of twofold. One, everyone can see when he really gets his head straight, he gives up the cleaner gimmick, puts away the spray cans and just really focuses on the in-ring. He's got no seconders or anything messing around. Then people could see just how good that he was. So I think after the G1, people were fired up for him versus Okada. But if you told anyone at the beginning of the G1 tournament that Kenny was going to win it, I think 9 times out of 10, you would have got a short reaction, if not 10 out of 10.
Yeah, I'm wondering now, we've discussed it, if that run that he had in the block itself was specifically designed to keep his powder dry and leave the most exciting opponents to the end to really kind of surprise people and you know, keep him fresh for that. I'm not sure, but let's get to the match itself. So
yep.
So the entrances to start with, it's really palpable watching it, even on New Japan World, the buzz from the crowd and the aura of both wrestlers just jumps off the screen, the chanting from the fans. It just feels a lot more heated than it does today. So you were there in the building for this one, right?
Yep.
So was that tangible to you, just the excitement of even just the entrances themselves?
Yeah, I remember that. In fact, probably that one, if I recall correctly, was on a Friday night. I seem to recall being in a suit with a colleague from work going to see that, whereas the final was on Saturday, I think, if I've got my dates right. And Saturday, the crowd was super, super hot. That was the same day where there was an 8-man between 4 Noah guys and Shibata and the dads, and I think we all knew what went down there, which is sort of unfortunate with the aftermath. But that crowd was so hot. And one thing I noticed that they don't allow anymore, but they've got the concept of the Hanamichi. Hanamichi is like basically the entranceway that the wrestlers go up and down to leave the building. And now what you're definitely not allowed to do, which I think is maybe something that happened because of COVID, was that you'll notice when the wrestlers leave the matches in back then, that people would sort of hang their hands over the rails and try and get a high five on the way out and stuff like that, which you can't do anymore. But I distinctly remember when Naito's music played on the final match, I don't know what he was doing. He must have been doing like a multi-man undercard or something like that. And it's just a few people waving around towels really hard. And I think the atmosphere back then, you know, I've been here 10 years. So I don't think this is just nostalgia talking. It was a lot hotter than what it is today. And I think still maybe post-COVID, people's willingness to go all out is still a little bit less than what it was back then.
So the bell rings. This is kind of tricky to do in a format like this, Fraser, because I'll just talk through stuff that I found notable about the match, but it's difficult to kind of make that a conversation because I don't know which parts of the match you have thoughts on. You know, I've done shows in the past where early on into my podcasting career, shall we say, where I've done shows like this where we're talking about a particular match and the co-host is just does a bit of play-by-play, so describes what happens in like the first 5 minutes of the match and then just stops talking, and I'm like, oh, okay, so am I supposed to jump in here with what I thought about this section of the match, where I might not have anything to say? So I'll just give my thoughts on the match.
Yeah, go ahead.
The way that it starts, just again, they're larger than life personas, just them spitting on each other, a pair of bastards essentially, but lovable bastards, because they're both occupying this tweener position at the moment, and Naito's controlling the pace, he's working Omega's knee, baiting him to the outside, and just they move so smoothly, and obviously that's in contrast to the way that I'm seeing them move in recent years, but they just seem so cavalier with spots that make me wince. Even today that look really brutal, because we've seen a lot of stuff as wrestling fans and New Japan fans, but just stuff like the body drop onto the apron. Yep. And that happens about 3 minutes into the match, and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. Like they start off strongly, and it escalates from there with Kenny teasing the powerbomb Naito onto the apron, but then he does the misdirection with that and just puts him through the table instead. And again, this is really early on into the match. I don't think we've even hit the 10-minute point there, and he's just dumping this guy through the table. And the most notable spot in the match for me is that top rope dive that Kenny does to the crowd, where Naito spectacularly fails to catch him. Like, he kind of gets an arm on him, but Kenny essentially just crashes and burns and splats into the ground. Then they just no let up, just dragon suplexes onto the apron. The stuff they're doing is insane. And viewing it through the eyes of a 2026 fan and knowing how banged up they are now, you can see how we got to that point. And even just the speed and the snap and the ferocity of just their normal wrestling moves feels remarkable. I think that selling is great with Kenny. He's constantly buckling under his injured knee, and Naito doing that kind of idiosyncratic zombie autopilot kind of fugue state he goes into. The counters, they're so slick, they're believable. Kenny's ability to just transition anything into a V-trigger. And when he hits that V-trigger, it just makes it look and sound like his knee has just caved Naito's head in. It sounds like a baseball bat. And they're essentially just taking turns dropping each other on their heads. They get into the closing stretch with Kenny landing his three moves. He does first of all, he teases the one-winged angel, but then transitions it into the Kreutz Wrath as Naito tries to escape from that. And Naito's face, he just does like this big surprised look of horror as he's about to get suplexed. Then the V-trigger, then the one-winged angel. And it's a very action-packed match, but it doesn't have that kind of ubiquitous reversal dance tease finisher back and forth thing that you might expect to see in a New Japan big match. It feels essentially like this is a showcase of heavyweight main event Kenny Omega, and Naito just a perfect dance partner for that. You know, we've seen some great wrestlers over the last few years. You know, we're spoiled, really. Guys like, you know, Prime Ibushi and Okada, Naito, Osprey, Shingo, even someone like Ishii, just to name but a few, but none of them appeal to my lizard brain quite the way that prime Kenny Omega did, who just operates with such speed and violence and unpredictability. It's just absolutely thrilling to watch.
Yeah, I'd just say maybe two or three things. I think it's a very good recap. Like, the first thing I just sort of thought I should check was how old they were at the time. So Naito was 34, Cleaner Kenny was 32, and Red Shoes, the referee, was only 79 back then. So they were all quite young compared to what they are now. But, you know, they're at an age with that wrestling style where they're probably, you know, selfishly, you could say as a New Japan fan, that while we've lost a lot of those guys, we had them for the best of times. And that does sound, I'm a bit reluctant to say that because, you know, health-wise and stuff like that, it's clearly taken its toll. But when it comes to the match, like you, I'm not really a sort of a play-by-play person or whatever, but I just made some observations of some of the biggest spots in the match. And I think you've covered most of them. But what I did notice was probably I'd just say three things, actually. One, the majority of the spectacular moves were done by Kenny. But got to remember, of course, that Naito's on the other side of those moves, bumping for all of them. And that backdrop to the apron, I watched that a couple of times. Like, I was just thinking, like, where does he put his hands or something like that to at least get some bracing? But there's none of that at all. It's like the spine on the very corner of the apron. But I thought the biggest bump of all of them, or the most dangerous one, which actually didn't come up in your list, was the one where Naito was like basically standing on the apron outside of the ring, and Kenny came along. I don't know if he triggered him or did something, and Naito just went straight back, not looking back, into the guardrail at a speed of knots. And you think, fucking hell, like some of the worst wrestling injuries have gone where guys have gone without being able to see like the turnbuckle pad behind them or whatever. And I thought, shit, that's dangerous. I think that might have been leading up to spot where Kenny eventually jumps over. The only thing I'd say in Naito's defense as to why he maybe didn't catch him that well, but he should have anyway, was that the position Kenny jumped over was quite close to the English announce table, such that Naito was kind of half over that, which made it even harder to catch him. But yeah, that was pretty brutal. He essentially flipped over and fell on the ground. So yeah, I mean, it's not that hard to tell why these guys are possibly not moving quite like they were. But yeah, I think you did a great job of covering it, and those would be probably the other two or three points that I would highlight about the match from watching it back today.
So what was the atmosphere like in the building during the match, at the end of the match? Like, did Omega winning feel like a genuine shock in the moment? Like, how did the crowd respond to that?
Yeah, it was definitely a shock. I think, you know, Naito had had a hot year, right? Like, you'd already recapped it. He won the New Japan Cup, which gave him the title shot at Invasion Attack. He won it. Yes, he dropped it again at Dominion. But, you know, there was that pathway back to the main event, which had been sort of supposedly cheated out of, or however you want to articulate it. And he was super hot, and Kenny was this unproven, just turned heavy DDT guy. So nobody was really expecting him to win. But one comment I think that Kenny made in his aftermatch promo was a bit more like, well, you all cheered for Naito at the start, but towards the end, you know, it swung around a little bit. And I think it was just that people were realizing sort of live, just shit, this is how good Kenny Omega actually is. But the shock was quite palpable. And you got to remember that same night, Goto had somehow made it through to the final as well. So it's a bit like the G1 semi-final of this year when Evil got through, when everyone was like, sort of, what the fuck is going on? Like, how is this even happening? So a final of Goto versus Kenny was probably, if Chris Samson was around doing his pick-ins back then, would not have been too high on people's guesses, I would have thought.
And Kenny cut an interesting promo after the match where it seems like he'd won the crowd over during the match, and they were cheering him. They wanted to cheer him, but he was essentially scolding them for that, saying, no, don't start cheering me now because I've given everything to you. And you at most of the match, have been chanting for Naito. So essentially, like, F you guys.
Yeah, exactly. And it's quite a stark contrast, rather, to the promo he cuts the next night, which, again, was in Nihongo and was much more of a, you know, just the fact like heels, generally speaking, if the foreigners and they do have a command of Nihongo to some extent, generally won't use it just because that seemed to be pandering to the audience. But he did do that. But I think he still wanted to keep things more on the heel side because he had Goto in the final the next day, right? So babyface wasn't necessarily the best of combination. So he kind of, I suppose, made them wait to cheer him for at least one more night again, I think.
And I can't really remember at the time, but
yeah,
it feels like if this is the sort of result that had happened now with similar wrestlers in similar positions, that there would be an insane crash out from the Naito contingent. So I don't know, like, were you aware of any significant upset from the Naito fans, or were they just happy that Kenny looked so great and they were just happy to cheer for him now?
Well, Naito was a bridesmaid on multiple occasions throughout that period, right? But it really kind of only started around that period. I think the one that really got to them, and if my memory serves me correctly, you were there and Damon was there in spirit but passed out on alcohol, was the one where he lost to Okada in the main event, where everybody was convinced Naito would win. So that sense of frustration around him not getting what he deserved, it wasn't that strong back then. People were kind of shocked, but it was like, okay, well, maybe this is like the first or second time this has happened. I guess I say second because he dropped the belt very quickly back to Okada at Dominion. But maybe something that the company felt but the fans didn't like, or the hardcore fans didn't like, was they thought Naito, again, is so popular, he doesn't necessarily need the belt. So at that stage, I wouldn't call it an outrage, but, you know, in the years to come, certainly you would see people getting very pansy about that kind of outcome.
So, I mean, you've picked this match. I'm curious to where it ranks in amongst your favourite wrestling matches. And to sort of take that further, where do you think the match ranks in their respective careers? Like, do you think this is the best Kenny Omega match and the best Tetsuya Naito match? And do you think they are each other's best opponents? Because I know there's a lot made of the rivalries between these wrestlers with other people, like Omega and Okada, or Naito and Okada, or Omega and Ibushi. So I've always sort of held the belief that actually Naito and Omega were each other's best opponents. Like, in terms of pure in-ring quality, belt-to-belt action, divorced from the narrative aspect of it, I think they are each other's best opponents. So, yeah, where does this match stack up for you and the rivalry as a whole?
I would probably say it's, you know, I've been watching since 10 years, let's say, and there's probably three matches in that time, or four matches actually, rather, that stand out for me, all for different reasons. And I don't necessarily know if I was ranking them per se exactly what the order would be, but the first one that I think really sold me on how good or how appealing New Japan was to me was when I went to Wrestle Kingdom 10, which was the first major event, and I saw Ishii versus Shibata, and I thought, holy shit, this is what people are legally allowed to do to each other in a ring. So that definitely hooked me in, but that may well have been a sort of a first impressions point. Then if I go chronologically, the second one would be this one, where I just thought the pure athleticism, the crispness of the moves, as you say, the flawless execution, the pace, the whippiness of everything was just amazing, and the willingness to bump and seemingly take very serious bumps, but still get up in a more real life situation, carry on and do the match when you've just been body slammed onto the corner of the apron, or you've taken a huge backward step into the guardrail, or you've done a jump over the guardrail onto the floor, not getting caught, it is very high ranking for me. The third one I thought was that I distinctly remember the first match, and I went to all four of the big Okada Omega matches live in New Japan, but I thought the first one was felt quite surreal, because they went about, I can't remember exactly, 42, 47 minutes, something like that. And I remember just how good that match was and the reaction fans were having when you would hear announcements you never heard before. It's like, Yonju Punkeka, like 40 minutes has passed. And everyone's like, fuck, I don't even think I've ever heard that before. And so that one, I think, was very, very special. And then the last one, and again, there may be some bias around who I know and who I don't know, but the last one that will stick in my mind, not necessarily because of the wrestling purity of it, but just the sheer, what would it be, stay in the memory value of it. It's a very poor choice of words, but you know what I mean. Was a dog pound match in Osaka between United Empire and the War Dogs. Like, that was like watching some sort of bizarre Vietnam movie or something like that. And I will never forget that. I was very close to the ring for that. Obviously, Hinade had a very unexpected and serious injury. You know, the ring was torn up. There was all sorts of things going on in there. And I'm not really a plunder guy. I don't tend to like that style of match very much. But there was just something about that that stood out for me. But if you take first impressions away, you take plunder kind of being memorable, I think it would be either out of the match we're talking about or the first Okada Omega match for me is the best I've seen in the 10 years I've been here.
Just the last one on this match. I don't know, did you go into this as a neutral? Like, did you find yourself cheering for one guy more or another? Like, which side do you find yourself connecting to? Like, Naito as this fan favorite anti-hero or Kenny as the outsider trying to break through?
Oh, no, I was a strong, strong Naito fan back then. Over time, I sort of, I don't know, probably into too many shows or something like that, but it sort of wore off. But that first year, I was big time on Naito, so I was desperate for him to win. And I hadn't, like most fans at the time, just seen the prowess of Kenny. You kind of realized it as the match played out, but I was strongly going for Naito. But I think by the end of the match, I was a lot more balanced about who would win because I thought I'd just seen something really amazing. So I'm less concerned exactly about who wins. But at the beginning of the match, definitely I was firmly in Naito's corner.
Yeah, so just wrap it up. It's a really important match, not just because it's great, but because of what it represents. So coming into it, as I've laid out, the main event scene had been built around guys like Tanahashi and Okada and Nakamura. So this felt like the first time the company had really handed the reins over to the next generation. And these guys representing different directions as well. So Naito representing New Japan becoming, you know, maybe a bit more unpredictable, more character driven, and Kenny representing New Japan embracing its more international side. And it also sort of strangely symbolic of the following decade. So Omega wins on this night, but Naito, in a lot of ways, becomes the emotional heart of New Japan in the years that followed. I think his failures and eventual triumph became the biggest story in New Japan of that era. So Omega obviously left for AEW in 2019. Naito stayed and achieved his long-awaited double title victory at Wrestle Kingdom 14, which we're all in attendance for. Wonderful night. So for you, looking back on how things panned out and, you know, maybe even over the last 11 years since this match, is there, like, whose career surprises you more, Naito's or Kenny's? Like, is there anything in there that really stands out to you looking back?
Probably I'd say maybe two or three things to finish. I think I'll start off with the first one. Maybe there's a word in Japanese called natsukashi, and what natsukashi means is nostalgic. And for me as a fan going back 10 years, and I saw myself not on camera for that night but the next night, is trying, and then when you see yourself you kind of think, oh yeah, I kind of remember what it was like. And there's a few things I just thought I would mention that were around at the time, which are no longer anymore. And one of them was Ozeki-san, the announcer. One thing I noticed is how quickly he counts to 20. And it's a bit of a sad story with him. I think he got sold a job opportunity, which didn't pan out. And you may or may not know, but he now runs a taco van. And outside of New Japan shows, he's out there selling his tacos before matches and stuff. Around the ring, there was a young Aaron Hinade, there was Yagi, Wato was around, and a much more younger-looking Kikuchi-san was there as well. Tiger Hattori was wrestling. That same night, Nagata did his G1 farewell with a much slimmer, or maybe slightly slimmer, Don Fale. And I think also you had on English commentary, it was Kevin Kelly, Scott Norton, and maybe back then a more babyface Rocky Romero. And there's one other guy. This is very much a Japanese live thing, so people probably won't know what I'm talking about. But there was a chant leader called Imaida-san. And Imaida-san was always the one that would be like, he always got his timing right, you know, when both guys were on the ground trying to recover. And he'd be like, Naito, Naito. And then everyone would collectively come in with him. And I heard from Okada and Hinade, I was asking them the other day, like, where the hell is that guy? Because he always just sit in the same seat. And apparently there's some scandal or something, and he's gone now. So that's a bit unfortunate. So that's a bit of the nostalgia value. In terms of the guy's career and who's do I think maybe outperformed expectations, I'd probably have to say Kenny's, just because no one really saw that coming until that match. I'm being a bit glib there. I'm sure some people did, but most people didn't. I think the last thing I would say, though, is I do feel, again, using a Japanese word, kanashi or sad, to think about where these guys are now. And January 1, I was at Budokan for Naito and Bushi taking on Manafuji and whoever it was. And just to see the condition that Naito was in, it made me feel really, really sad. And January 1's been a bit of a January 1 Noah shows have been a bit of a death knell for people. Bushi, a couple of years ago, I went to that one where he fought Marufuji, ironically, again in a singles match. And it's quite sad to see where these guys are now. And it's a bit like the Shibata thing, right? Like, you see headbutts back in the day and you think, you may or may not have liked them at the time, but they make you wince. And when you see some of these bumps, they kind of make you wince. And even Kenny's been, you know, through diverticulosis and other things. So, you know, there is a price to pay for that style for sure. And I think, you know, trying to be a fan of pro wrestling, but also empathetic towards the people that entertain you, I think it's important for the guys to try and make sure that they're not doing, let's say, too much of that. It's amazing on the night, but, you know, that kind of stuff stays with you for the rest of your life. So I just hope they'll be careful, that's all.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. If people look back on this, particularly wrestlers, on this kind of style and realize that it is unsustainable in the long term, and if they've changed up their own styles accordingly. I mean, you could certainly look at someone like Will Ospreay and how he's modified his style as he's got older. And even sort of looking at a more contemporary example, looking at a guy like Konosuke Takeshita, who, when he first was making appearances for New Japan, just absolute balls to the wall, 100 miles an hour action. But now, I don't know if, you know, someone's had a word with him or if he's banged up, but he's slowed down considerably even over the space of like the 2 years that he's been with New Japan. So yeah, it's just interesting to see this kind of style. You don't really see matches like this with quite this speed and intensity anymore in New Japan. So I'm not sure if it's a stylistic choice that wrestlers are deciding not to have this kind of match, or they would love to have this kind of match, but they're just not able to do it just of what a pair of physical phenoms Naito and Omega were in their prime. But it's certainly a really interesting one to look back on. Last question I have for you, Fraser. Like, one of the interesting things about New Japan wrestling in general is that it does move in cycles. And since you've lived in Japan for more than a decade, have you noticed any patterns? And do you think the company today is in a similar place to where it was back then, rebuilding around a new generation? And is there like a 2026 equivalent match that you think could have a similar impact to this one?
No, if I was to draw some sort of a graph, forgetting sort of what happened in between, if you had a sort of a top level of 100 and you had a bottom level of 0, there would be a clear gap between where the company was in 2016, I would say much higher than what it is today, unfortunately. And I think that is just the absence of star power. People talk about it being a star-powered business. Everybody's got their different theories about why that may or may not be the case. I think, not to be too anti-AEW, but the reality is the wealth of that company and maybe the false economy that it's created means that it's not apples and apples anymore, right? It's apples and oranges, just in terms of a weak yen, huge amounts of cash available for both WWE to the extent that they want to spend it, huge amounts of cash in AEW, and we know they want to spend it. So without sounding too pessimistic, it's just quite hard to see the path forward to reach that. I think to your earlier point, probably the only thing they really can do is to try and look to do the multi-year deals more often. So it's very encouraging to know that Callum's got a 3-year contract, and perhaps that's what they need to be doing across the board with a lot more. And I realize he's not the only guy that's done that, but that's probably the formula for doing it. Bushi Road itself, just to touch on that very briefly, because I think that's relevant to the conversation. I'm keeping an eye on its stock price at the minute because I'm thinking about getting back in again. They're not in the strongest of financial positions. I thought maybe Tanahashi's retirement would put more money in the coffers as opposed to just his own pockets to perhaps free up more money to do things with. And as we know, there's a few more maybe on the junior side of things, a few more guys coming in. But I would say there's quite a clear gap between where they were at 2016, which, as you say, was sort of early on in that sort of golden era, versus where we are now. Unfortunately, I still think there's still quite a way to go.
So before we call it a day, Fraser, is there anything else you want to talk about either this match or New Japan in general before we wrap it up?
I just say two quick things. One thing I'd recommend is if people are going to go through the hassle of going back through New Japan World to find the semi-final of 2016, the one we just talked about, I would highly, highly, highly recommend going and watching the eight-man the next day between the four guys invading from Noah and Shibata and crew. Again, depending on your tolerance for mistakes that led to bad outcomes, if you can get past that, that match is definitely worth watching. Then on a personal note, I think the people who are patrons of your show have probably heard me before, so I don't think I really need to plug too much. Just be at Fraser Japan if you feel like a follow. All I really do is go to live matches and post photos. That's about it. And maybe my bigger plug these days would be for the Ryokan. So if you are interested in coming, and as I said, I've got one of your Discourse members this month coming, easiest thing to do, I think, for you would just be to send me a DM over X or Twitter or whatever and be happy to help you out and happy to host you. And as I say, hopefully we will have a bit more of a New Japan sort of Ryokan Hall of Fame going on. Three members inducted so far, and I'm hopeful by halfway through the year that number will be six.
Well, thank you very much, Fraser, for your time. It's been lovely talking to you as always, and thank you, patrons, for your continued support, and we will catch you next time.
Detonator. Yeah. On the one. Hi, I'm Andrew Rich. And if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.